Monica Rayburn can't escape the shadow of her sister's suicide or the murders that rocked her small town. 5 years ago, five cheerleaders died within 3 months, two murdered, two in a car accident, and finally, Monica's sister Jennifer took her own life. Now living in a new house her mother hoped would fix everything, Monica carries secrets of her own while navigating high school dance team tryouts and recovering from a secret abortion. When she discovers mysterious letters sent to her police officer stepfather Tom containing the cryptic message, "I know it wasn't him, connect the dots," Monica begins questioning everything she thought she knew about the tragedies. The Cheerleaders has become a cult favorite among true crime enthusiasts, with readers praising Thomas's ability to craft a mystery that feels both authentic and chilling. Like her previous works, this novel showcases Thomas's talent for exploring the dark underbelly of suburban teenage life with unflinching honesty. Monica's family has moved to a spacious new home in the affluent Oakwood Heights neighborhood, but the real reason remains unspoken. No one wanted to buy their previous house on what locals called the Street of Horrors. The stigma of Sycamore Lane follows Monica everywhere, from whispered conversations at the grocery store to sideways glances at school. She carefully avoids the relocated trophy case in the main hallway, containing a photo of her sister Jennifer with four cheerleader friends, their red and gold uniforms bright against the autumn backdrop. By the end of that cheerleading season 5 years ago, every girl in that photo was dead, their smiling faces a haunting reminder of the tragedy that rocked their small town of Millbrook. The deaths began with Juliana Ruiz and Susan Berry, both 16, found brutally murdered in Susan's colonial-style home on a quiet Sunday morning. Their bodies were discovered by Susan's mother, returning early from church. A month later, cheerleaders Bethany Williams and Colleen O'Connor died when their cheery red Volkswagen crashed through a guardrail at Osprey's Bluff, a winding road notorious for its dangerous curves. 2 weeks after that, Jennifer Rayburn, Monica's vivacious older sister, took her own life, leaving behind only a brief note saying, "I'm sorry." The community, desperate for closure, rallied around the narrative that Jack Canning, Susan's 52-year-old neighbor, was responsible for the murders. Monica's stepfather, Tom, a decorated police officer of 15 years, shot and killed Canning during what was described as a violent arrest attempt. But something doesn't add up in Monica's mind. While searching through Tom's home office for painkillers to ease her recurring migraines, Monica discovers four identical manila envelopes addressed to him, each postmarked November 7th, the anniversary of her sister's suicide. Each envelope contains the same yearbook photo of her sister with her friends, their faces circled in red ink, and the cryptic message written in block letters, "I know it wasn't him, connect the dots." The handwriting appears feminine, precise, and somehow familiar. This discovery sends Monica down a rabbit hole of investigation, questioning the official narrative she's accepted for years. When Monica researches the murders online, she finds troubling inconsistencies in the case. News reports from the Millbrook Gazette indicate Jack Canning was merely reaching into a kitchen drawer when Tom shot him, contradicting what Monica had been told about Canning pointing a loaded weapon at officers. Court records show Canning had a previous arrest from 1998 for a lewd act with a minor, supporting the narrative of a predator living in their neighborhood. However, that charge was later dismissed due to lack of evidence. The mysterious letters suggest someone believes the wrong man was blamed for the cheerleaders' deaths, and Monica begins to notice other details that don't align, like how her sister's suicide note was typed, not handwritten, and how Bethany and Colleen's brake lines showed signs of tampering that were never fully investigated. Monica's investigation takes a dramatic turn during a rainy afternoon when she discovers her dead sister's phone concealed beneath false paperwork in Tom's meticulously locked desk drawer. The phone's scratched case features a sun-faded photo of Jen with her fellow cheerleaders Juliana and Susan at their last competition, all three girls beaming in their blue and gold uniforms, unaware of their approaching fate. When Tom's car unexpectedly pulls into the driveway, Monica's heart races as she quickly pockets the phone, her mind spinning with questions about why her stepfather kept this crucial piece of evidence hidden for 5 years. Safe in her bedroom, Monica frantically searches through old boxes until she finds a compatible charger. Her hands shake as she powers up the phone, surprised to find the security features disabled, suggesting someone had accessed it after Jen's death. Though the text messages have been systematically erased, she uncovers a call log revealing an unknown number that connected with Jen for 17 minutes at 2:47 p.m. on the day she died. Following her instincts, Monica texts the number, carefully identifying herself as Jen's sister. After several nerve-wracking hours, the mysterious correspondent engages in a cryptic exchange before delivering an ominous warning. Be careful. Some doors should stay closed. The investigation leads Monica to veteran crime journalist Daphne Furman, whose controversial article, Blind Justice: When Police Get Too Close, questioned whether the emotional involvement of local law enforcement, many of whom had children at the same high school, compromised the cheerleader murder investigation. Over coffee at a quiet diner, Daphne methodically outlines disturbing inconsistencies. Despite Juliana's extensive injuries and reported blood loss, no bloody clothes were ever recovered. The Barry family's sophisticated security system showed no signs of forced entry, contradicting the official theory about Jack Canning's break-in. And several witness statements about suspicious vehicles were never followed up. The mystery takes a chilling turn when Monica receives an anonymous text directing her to check inside the unfinished house across the street, third bedroom, look behind the drywall. Following the instructions, she discovers fresh footprints in the construction dust, a distinctive clove cigarette butt, and a weathered envelope wedged behind loose drywall. Inside, she finds a note in Jen's distinctive looping handwriting reading, "I'm not okay. They won't stop watching," and a response written in precise block letters, "I see everything you do." Later that evening, while searching through Jen's belongings, Monica uncovers a disturbing poem hidden in her sister's annotated copy of Wuthering Heights. Written in the same meticulous block lettering, the verses detail intimate moments of Jen's daily routine, a stalker's manifesto documenting her movements with terrifying precision. Monica's English teacher, Mr. Ward, reveals that Ethan McCready was in Jen's class and was expelled for writing down the names of all the cheerleaders in his notebook, which the administration considered a hit list. Mr. Ward mentions that Ethan sat behind Jen and wrote her a poem, though he never seemed violent. When Monica confronts Tom about Ethan, he dismisses her concerns, explaining that Ethan was physically incapable of overpowering the cheerleaders, who were strangled by someone much stronger. Through flashbacks, we learn that Jen had a complicated relationship with Ethan. When Jen was feeling isolated from her friends, Ethan approached her after retrieving a note she'd written in class saying, "I'm not okay." He offered to talk, showing a gentler side than his public persona. However, Monica also discovers a disturbing incident where Ethan was bullied in the cafeteria and responded by making a gun shape with his fingers as he walked away. Monica eventually confronts Ethan about the notes in the unfinished house. He admits to being the mystery texter and reveals he's been sending the anonymous letters to Tom on the anniversary of Jen's death. Ethan claims to have witnessed something crucial the night of the murders, Juliana arguing with someone in a hoodie on the Barry's back deck while a dark pickup truck was parked across the street. According to Ethan, when he tried to report this to police, Tom interrupted his interview and threatened him. Ethan's testimony seems convincing until Monica later realizes a crucial detail. The Barrys had installed a privacy fence around their backyard months before the murders, making it impossible for Ethan to have seen anything from the woods as he claimed. When confronted with this inconsistency, Ethan reveals an even more shocking truth. He wasn't in the woods that night, but leaving Monica's house, specifically sneaking out of Jen's bedroom window after comforting her when she was sick. As Monica continues her investigation, she meets Ginny Cordero, a former gymnast who becomes her unlikely ally. Together, they examine old yearbook preparation photos from 5 years ago, featuring Susan Berry and the cheerleading squad. In a sequence of pictures, they notice Juliana Ruiz first smiling with the group, then retreating to the fence, appearing upset or possibly crying while looking at her phone just hours before her murder. Monica calls Juliana's mother, who reveals that Jen and Susan Berry weren't speaking to each other before the murders, something Juliana had wanted to stay out of. This leads Monica to Carly Amato, a former cheerleader who transferred to their school during Jen's final year. When Monica tracks down Carly at her community college, Carly reveals she was new to the cheer team that year and thought Jen's friends were conceited. More shockingly, Carly claims that Susan Berry saw Jen slip something into Ethan's locker the same day she spotted Ethan writing his infamous hit list, and Susan reported this to the principal. Monica refuses to believe her sister was involved with Ethan's hit list, but realizes this might explain why Jen and Susan weren't speaking. Susan had betrayed Jen by going to the principal instead of talking to her directly. However, Carly's story doesn't fully add up. When Monica speaks with Patrice, another former cheerleader, she learns that Carly was desperate for acceptance and had a strange power over Juliana Ruiz. Patrice explains that Carly would brag loudly about parties she and Juliana attended with older men, though this behavior wasn't typical of Juliana. The investigation leads Monica to Allie Lewandowski, the former cheerleading coach. Allie reveals she never kicked Carly off the team. As rumored, Carly quit after Allie confronted her about finding Carly's earring in her boyfriend's car. Allie's boyfriend claimed he and his friend bought beer for Carly, and the earring fell out in his back seat. This seemingly minor detail becomes crucial as Monica begins to piece together the true events leading to the murders. Through flashbacks, we gain insight into Jen's final weeks. In September, Jen noticed her friend Juliana growing close with transfer student Carly Amato. This unsettled Jen, who remembered seeing Carly behaving strangely at the county fair, possibly on drugs. When Carly convinced their coach Allie to consider letting them perform a dangerous swan dive stunt that was illegal at high school level, Jen's concern deepened. By October, Jen was struggling with feeling isolated from her friends. During spirit night, she discovered Juliana had disappeared and followed her outside, where she found Juliana with Carly Amato. Hidden behind an SUV, Jen overheard them discussing pills from Carly's mother's prescription. A black pickup arrived, and despite Jen's silent alarm, Juliana got in with Carly and the unknown male driver. Later that month, Jen contracted a severe case of strep throat that prevented her from participating in homecoming activities. While texting with Juliana, she finally confronted her about seeing her get into a car with Carly. Instead of denying it, Juliana responded, "There's so much I have to tell you. It's not what you think." That night, Ethan visited Jen at her home, revealing his mother was dying. When he asked about Jen's troubles, she admitted feeling like she was losing her friends. After Juliana and Susan's murders, Jen attended Juliana's wake. Overwhelmed with anger upon discovering Jack Canning's wake was also being held at the same funeral home, she ran outside where she encountered Carly Amato. They exchanged bitter words, with Jen blaming Carly for Juliana's death. Later that night, Jen sneaked out to Ethan's house. Though they became intimate, Ethan stopped when he realized Jen's emotional state. Jen broke down, confessing she wished she had died too, as she was supposed to be with her friends that night. As Monica's investigation deepens, she uncovers disturbing evidence about Brandon Mitchell, a 22-year-old substitute teacher who had briefly worked at her school following their summer acquaintance. Through methodical analysis of digital communications and social media, Monica discovers that Brandon had formed an inappropriate relationship with a minor student, Juliana Martinez, rather than the initially suspected relationship with Carly. The crucial breakthrough emerges when Monica identifies a distinctive marking on Brandon's leg in a recovered social media photograph. This detail corresponds with evidence from the Berry residence incident, confirmed through veterinary records of a defensive injury caused by their family dog. During an unexpected confrontation at Monica's house while her parents are away, she maintains her composure enough to document the interaction electronically. In the garage, surrounded by household items, Monica manages to maintain distance and control of the situation while seeking answers. Under questioning, Brandon reveals his motivation. Juliana had threatened to report his misconduct to authorities. His attempt to prevent this disclosure led to a tragic confrontation at her residence. When Susan Berry investigated the disturbance, Brandon's actions resulted in two fatalities to conceal his crimes. The situation intensifies when Brandon becomes aggressive, but Ginny's timely intervention prevents further harm. Though momentarily overcome with emotion, Monica chooses to let the justice system handle the consequences. Law enforcement arrives promptly to take control of the situation. At the police station, Detective Harrison presents the case details. The evidence supports multiple serious charges, including the recorded admission. The investigation creates professional complications for Harrison due to his connection to Monica's family. When Monica expresses concern about a possible connection to her friend's earlier passing, her mother helps her understand that the documented circumstances of Jen's death remain separate from these events. The investigation reveals how a predatory individual exploited their position of authority, highlighting the importance of maintaining proper boundaries and reporting suspicious behavior in educational settings. The resolution brings justice for the victims while demonstrating the value of careful evidence gathering and allowing proper legal processes to prevail. As the case against Brandon intensifies, Monica receives a pivotal email from Daphne Furman that shatters her understanding of recent events. The email reveals that Phil Cordero, Ginny's father, was seen at Murphy's Bar on October 27, a week before the cheerleader murders, directly contradicting Ginny's adamant claim that her father had left town on October 18th. This 9-day discrepancy sets off alarm bells for Monica, forcing her to question everything she thought she knew about her closest friend's truthfulness. The final chapter peels back layers of deception through a haunting flashback to 5 years earlier. On a stormy November night, Ginny's father, drunk and belligerent despite a restraining order, arrived at her grandmother's house in his mud-splattered pickup truck. The court order had been issued following his arrest for domestic violence, specifically breaking her mother's wrist during a late-night confrontation. Despite Ginny's grandmother's protests, Phil forced his teenage daughter into the truck. Their fateful journey included a stop at a 7-Eleven, where Phil, in what would later prove to be a cruel twist of irony, confronted three men who were harassing two young girls outside the store. These girls were Bethany Martinez and Colleen O'Brien, the same teenagers whose lives would end that night. Phil's intervention, while seemingly heroic, was marked by slurred speech and aggressive posturing that left Ginny mortified. Back on the road, conditions deteriorated rapidly. Rain hammered against the windshield as Phil swerved erratically across the wet pavement, ignoring Ginny's increasingly desperate pleas to slow down. The defining moment came when he reached to change the radio station, dismissing Ginny's warnings with a wave of his hand. Seconds later, their truck smashed through the guardrail at Cooper's Bend, a crash that instantly killed Bethany and Colleen in their small Honda Civic. Ginny managed to free herself from the overturned truck, her survival instinct driving her through the pain of what would later be diagnosed as a fractured collarbone. When she returned to the driver's side window, she found her father trapped upside down, water from the swollen creek already reaching his chest. His desperate pleas for help, "Baby, please just unbuckle me," echoed in the rain. In that crucial moment, Ginny made a decision that would haunt her for years. She stepped back and watched as the rising water carried the truck, with her father still inside, into the depths of Lake Morrison. When discovered by her mother hours later, Ginny constructed an elaborate lie. Her father had injured her in a rage before abandoning them. This fabrication became her shield, protecting her from the truth of her actions while simultaneously justifying them. In her mind, her father's death served as punishment for both the accidental killing of the teenagers and years of systematic abuse against her mother. This long-buried secret explains Ginny's recent lie about her father's departure date, a desperate attempt to maintain the carefully constructed narrative that had protected her for 5 years. In the aftermath of Brandon's arrest, Monica's life undergoes a seismic shift that reverberates through every aspect of her daily existence. When news breaks about Brandon's arrest for statutory rape and assault, the whispers in the school hallways quickly connect the dots to identify Monica as the victim. Yet, contrary to her fears, instead of facing ridicule or ostracism, she encounters waves of genuine sympathy from both teachers and students, a response that somehow makes it both easier and harder to bear. Monica makes the difficult decision to quit the dance team, a choice that feels both like a loss and a liberation. When her coach attempts to convince her to stay, Monica stands firm, explaining that this isn't about Brandon or trauma. It's about finally making choices that align with her true desires rather than others' expectations. The dance team had been her attempt to follow in Jen's footsteps, but now she realizes she needs to forge her own path. On the solemn anniversary of Jen's death, Monica makes a pilgrimage to Osprey's Bluff, where Bethany and Colleen's lives came to their tragic end. Standing at the edge, she takes in the steep embankment leading to the dark waters below, understanding with newfound clarity why Ginny's behavior had seemed so erratic throughout their investigation. The physical reality of the location brings a fresh perspective to everything she thought she knew. Her phone buzzes with a text from Ethan McCrady, whose simple message, "Maybe now I can let her go," captures the bittersweet nature of closure. The weight of secrets continues to shape relationships in unexpected ways. While the truth about the cheerleaders' murders has been unveiled, other mysteries remain carefully guarded, particularly Ginny's involvement in her father's death. These shared secrets create invisible bonds between survivors, a complex web of understanding and complicity that both connects and constrains them. Monica makes a conscious decision to move forward, allowing herself to think about the girls a little less each passing day. Yet she acknowledges that complete forgetting isn't possible or even desirable. Their stories have become inextricably woven into the fabric of her own. Each step toward healing comes with the recognition that recovery isn't linear. Some days the memories feel distant, while other days they return with stunning clarity. The novel concludes as a profound exploration of how truth, grief, and healing intersect in messy, complicated ways. For Monica, uncovering the truth about the cheerleaders' deaths provides answers, but also raises new questions about human nature and the price of silence. She learns that closure doesn't mean forgetting or even full understanding. Sometimes it simply means accepting that some questions will remain unanswered, some wounds will leave scars, and moving forward requires carrying both the weight of truth and the burden of uncertainty.